Welcome to A Katra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Katra AI. Hello and welcome. Today we're really diving deep into John Banville's The Sea.
Mm-hmm.
The sources we have show this isn't just a novel, it's this profound look at memory, grief, and how the past, you know, how slippery it is, shapes us now.
Absolutely.
So our mission today is to try and unpack that. The story centers on Max Morgan. He's an older art historian, and he goes back to this seaside town from his childhood after his wife dies.
Right, seeking refuge, maybe.
Exactly, but it kind of unlocks this old trauma. So the big question for you, the listener, is really Banville's question. How do those echoes from the past, maybe the ones we've idealized or buried, still shape how we see ourselves and deal with loss today?
That's a perfect way to put it. Banville, well, they call him a master prose stylist, don't they?
They certainly do.
And it's true. His writing, it sort of blurs that line between prose and poetry. You get pulled into the characters' heads.
Yeah.
The plot almost feels secondary sometimes.
Yeah, it's more about the internal landscape.
Exactly. It's immersive, intellectual,
mm-hmm.
you know, less about what happens, more about how it feels to be lost in memory like that. Honestly, it's such a rewarding read.
I completely agree. And to really get it, let's talk a bit about the man himself, John Banville.
Okay.
He's a huge figure in contemporary Irish literature, born in Wexford, 1945. And he gets compared to some heavy hitters, Henry James, Nabokov.
Beckett, Joyce.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For that incredible precision and psychological depth. What I find really interesting is his range. Literary fiction, sure, but also crime novels under the name Benjamin Black.
Shows real versatility.
It does. Books like The Book of Evidence, The Untouchable, Eclipse, they all grapple with these big themes. Guilt, redemption, and this idea of how slippery truth and memory are, which is key for The Sea.
Definitely.
And The Sea, well, it won the Man Booker Prize in 2005. It's often seen as the final part of his art trilogy.
A huge achievement. And when you read Banville, you see this almost obsessive focus on language.
Yeah.
It's not just showing off. His sentences have this musical quality. Every word feels deliberate.
Mm-hmm.
And that, plus his philosophical depth, you can feel the influence of like European existentialism, modernism.
Right.
It makes The Sea more than just a story. It's this deep dive into how we remember, how we grieve, how we actually, you know, build our sense of self from those broken pieces of the past.
It really forces you to think about your own memories, doesn't it?
It really does.
Mm-hmm.
Which brings us right to the core of the novel. Max Morton, middle-aged art historian, just completely shattered because his wife, Anna, died from cancer.
Yeah.
So he escapes basically to Ballylis, this quiet seaside village from his childhood.
Back to the Cedars.
Back to the Cedars, yeah. This faded guest house, but it's lodged deep in his memory. And it's not just a physical trip, it's like a psychological retreat.
A deep dive into his own head.
Totally. And he's caught between these two sort of currents of memory. There's the raw grief for Anna, which is very present.
Very visceral.
And then these hazy, sometimes really idealized memories of this one summer from his childhood, spending time with this captivating family, the Graces.
And that's where Banville really hooks you, I think. The main conflict isn't external. It's all happening inside Max's head.
Mm-hmm.
He's trying to navigate this, well, treacherous landscape of his own memory. And you start to wonder, you know, can we ever really know the past?
Or is it just a story we tell ourselves?
Exactly. A story we create to deal with the pain we're feeling right now. For me, the book feels like a kind of dual elegy.
Oh, interesting. How so?
One for his wife, obviously, but also one for that lost childhood innocence. It's about how one traumatic event can just ripple through a whole life.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's meet some of these people swirling around in Max's memory. First, Max himself. He's our narrator, our protagonist.
The art historian.
Right, an intellectual. And he often uses the language of art, you know, painting, aesthetics. Almost like a shield.
To keep messy emotions at bay.
Precisely. So his journey isn't really about straightforward healing. It's more like a deconstruction. Moving from thinking about his pain to actually finally feeling it.
And then there's Anna Morton, his late wife.
Huh.
She's gone when the book starts. But wow, she feels so present.
Incredibly vibrant in his memories.
Yeah, he remembers her as like earthy, sensual, just fiercely alive, which is such a contrast to Max's own detachment.
Mm.
But he also can't escape the, you know, the brutal reality of her dying from cancer.
Yeah.
That forces him to confront the messy truth of the recent past against those more polished childhood memories. She's like the real world he's lost.
And central to those childhood memories are the Graces, the Grace family.
Well, yes, the Graces.
For young Max, they were almost mythical, weren't they? Glamorous, rich, mysterious.
Everything his own life wasn't, maybe?
Probably. There's Chloe Grace, one of the twins. Quite assertive. She's his first big adolescent crush, a symbol of sort of lost potential.
And a brother.
Miles Grace, the other twin. He's mute, very enigmatic, a kind of an unsettling figure that summer.
Mm.
And their mother, Connie Grace, she becomes the focus of Max's deeper, more complex fascination, like the epitome of adult womanhood to him then.
Right.
And then there are others, like Rose, the mysterious maid, and Miss Vavasor. She runs the Cedars now, but she used to be the Grace's governess.
Ah, so she holds some secrets.
Exactly. Her knowledge turns out to be crucial. Oh, and finally, Claire Morden, Max's daughter. She's kind of the voice of reality cutting through his, well, his wallowing.
Grounding force.
Yeah. So the story really kicks off when Max gets back to the Cedars. It's meant to be a refuge, but it quickly turns into this psychological battleground for him.
Right.
The place itself, the smells, the sounds of the sea, the whole landscape, it all acts as these powerful memory triggers.
Pulling him back.
Pulling him back, almost whether he wants to go or not, to that summer with the Graces. It's like the past isn't just something he remembers. It's actively reaching out to him.
Wow.
And Banville's structure, the way he tells the story, it perfectly mirrors how memory works, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's not linear at all.
No. He weaves together three different timelines, and they just bleed into each other, just like our minds jump around.
Yeah.
So you've got the present in Ballyliss, which feels kind of decaying, static, and his absence is just huge. Max is like a ghost there.
Haunting his own past.
Pretty much. Then there's the recent past, these sharp, fragmented flashbacks of Anna's illness, her death. Very visceral, very real.
Contrasting with the childhood memories.
Exactly, because then you have the distant past, that summer with the Graces, and that's where all the nostalgic energy, but also the trauma comes from. It's remembered as this golden, idyllic time first.
At first, because that idealized summer, well, it leads somewhere dark, doesn't it? There's a turning point.
Huge one.
The climax is the shocking tragedy, Chloe and Miles drowning in the sea.
It's brutal.
It's not just a sad memory, it's this moment of just inexplicable horror. It shatters his innocence completely.
And becomes this primal loss, yeah. Right? Long before Anna.
Yeah, it's like this magnetic point his mind keeps getting drawn back to. You feel like it shaped everything for him afterwards. Love, loss, his whole understanding of life and death.
And then the resolution, it comes quietly almost in a conversation Max has with Miss Vavasor.
The former governess.
Right. She finally reveals the last piece of the story, the hidden piece.
Which is?
The incestuous relationship. That was the dark secret behind the twins' parentage.
Wow. Yeah.
And that revelation just, it reframes that entire summer. It tears down all of Max's idealized memories and shows the darkness that was lurking under the Grace's glamorous surface all along.
So what does that do to Max? Does he find peace?
Not catharsis in the usual sense. No big breakdown or sudden healing. It's more like a measure of peace, an acceptance of ambiguity, of complexity.
Okay.
It marks this slow, hesitant turn back towards the world, towards living. It's not about finding neat answers. It's about learning to live with the questions, maybe.
That feels very true to life, actually.
I think so. So if we zoom out, what are the big themes Banville's really digging into here?
Well, top of the list has to be memory and its unreliability.
Definitely.
Max isn't just remembering, he's actively constructing the past, isn't he?
Yeah.
Shaping it to fit his needs now.
Sometimes consciously, sometimes not, yeah.
His whole journey is about realizing how those childhood memories got filtered through, you know, decades of adult life, guilt, wishful thinking.
It's a powerful point. Memory isn't a recording, it's a creative act,
yeah.
Often self-serving.
Right, and that links straight into how Banville shows grief as a dislocation. It's not presented as neat stages like we sometimes think.
No, it's chaos.
It completely shatters your sense of reality.
Yeah.
For Max, the world loses its moorings. He's adrift on this sea of loss.
And it's so striking how the past feels more real to him than the present.
And the dead feel more present than the living.
Yeah.
It's this profound look at how absence can be such a powerful presence.
That constant presence leads to another theme. The persistent power of the past.
Mm.
That drowning incident, it's the primal loss. It shapes his ability to love, his understanding of death, for decades.
It underlines that idea that the past, Faulkner's line, the past is never dead, it's not even past.
Exactly. It lives inside us, influences us constantly, whether we admit it or not.
And for Max, being an art historian, that theme of art versus reality is huge.
Oh, yeah.
He's always using the language of art, referencing painters like Bonnard. It's like a defense mechanism.
Creating distance.
Yeah, putting this aesthetic frame around raw, painful feelings.
Yeah.
But the book really questions if that works, ultimately.
Can art really shield you from suffering and death?
Banville seems to suggest, maybe not entirely, it's a beautiful shield, but fragile.
And briefly, there's also the illusory nature of identity. Max's sense of self, built around being a husband, a scholar, it just collapses.
Forcing him to face his emptiness.
Yeah. And you also see threads of class consciousness, his fascination with the Grace's status, and of course the big one, aging and mortality. Anna's death makes that unavoidable for him.
So many layers.
There really are. Now, how does Banville pull all this off? Let's talk about his style, the devices he uses.
Well, the first-person unreliable narrative is key. We're right inside Max's head.
Super intimate access.
But because it's Max, we also see his biases, his romanticizing, his distortions. It reveals his complexity.
And the structure, non-linear, associative, it's brilliant.
It perfectly mimics how memory actually works, doesn't it? Jumping between timelines fluidly, it feels completely organic to Max's state of mind.
Yeah, not forced at all.
And then, of course, there's Banville's prose itself. That lyrical, dense prose style.
His signature.
It's incredibly dense, yes, mm-hmm. but also so precise, so musical. Mm-hmm. Long sentences, perfectly chosen words.
And that style, it reflects Max too, doesn't it? His intellectual mind trying to control the chaos through precise description.
Exactly. It's like the language itself is part of his coping mechanism.
The symbolism is incredibly rich too. Almost another character in the book.
Oh, definitely. The sea itself is massive.
It's everything, right? Death, continuity, destruction, renewal.
The indifference of nature, time, the subconscious.
And memory itself. That shimmering surface hiding unknown depths. Perfect metaphor.
And the cedars, the guest house. It's not just a setting.
No, it's a symbol of memory, of the past itself. Like a storehouse for echoes.
And all the water imagery, the drowning motif.
Yeah.
It connects all the losses together, creates this inescapable current.
Banville also uses light and color so effectively. That golden light for the idealized past.
Contrasted with the gray washed out present. Yeah, it instantly signals the timeline and the mood.
And Ekphrasis, those descriptions of paintings, like Bonnard's, they aren't just decorative.
No, they're like little windows into Max's thinking. How he tries to frame life like a painting. It's metaphorical commentary.
Let's share a few of those memorable lines, those voices from the deep. This one sums it up so well. The past beats inside me like a second heart.
Oh, that's powerful. Captures it perfectly. Memory is this living, vital thing inside you.
Inescapable.
And this one is just profound.
We carry the dead with us only until we die ourselves, and then it is we who are carried. Puts personal loss in such a vast perspective, doesn't it? The continuity, the cycle.
Yeah, memory, legacy, mortality, all wrapped up in one sentence.
And capturing that youthful intensity. I had never known such fierce wanting as I knew that summer.
Yeah. First love, that awakening. Yeah. But it also hints at how those early desires set a pattern for his whole life.
Definitely.
And one more on grief. Anna is everywhere and nowhere, which is what the dead are.
That captures that weird paradox of grief so well, the intense presence and the utter absence simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
So the emotional impact of the sea is just immense. Because it looks at grief so unflinchingly in all its messiness.
Right. It doesn't offer easy answers or neat comfort.
No comfortable consolations here. It forces you as a reader to face the idea that some losses, you don't get over them.
You endure them. You integrate them.
Exactly.
And I think that's why it resonates so much. It reflects that universal thing of how the past is always bleeding into the present, often in ways we barely grasp. It suggests that self-knowledge is vital, but also painful.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't guarantee peace, but maybe offers a path to being more authentic.
So the feeling you're left with isn't despair exactly, it's more like
profound melancholy.
Yeah, but tempered by the sheer beauty of the writing, maybe. And Max does find this gradual acceptance of uncertainty.
Which feels like a form of maturity, maybe.
Yeah.
Challenging those neat ideas of healing or recovery.
Yeah, maybe maturity is just learning to live with the ambiguity, the incompleteness.
Mm-hmm.
So this whole deep dive into the sea, it really hammers home that understanding loss means grappling with memory's shifting tides.
And accepting that some truths might always stay just out of reach. The novel's beauty lies in showing that accepting life's mysteries might be the deepest kind of resilience.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.